broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City, 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Bluebird, bluebird, what do you feed on? Is it true you gobble up worms, you swallow bugs, and your bill picks up corn and seed, berries? This is only part of the answer. Your feathers have captured a piece of smooth blue sky. Your wings are burnished with lake morning blue. It is not a worm blue, nor a bug blue, nor the blue of corn or berry you shine with. Bluebird, we come to you for facts, for valuable information, for secret reports. Bluebird, tell us, what do you feed on? Carl Sandburg. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. Our program is in two segments today. In the first half, we're going to talk about what the bluebird feeds on, and in fact, what we all feed on. My guests are Lee DeZamora and Master Gardener Denise Swain. Lee DeZamora is an award-winning botanical artist and landscape architect. Her professional projects include the Jefferson Memorial and Dumbarton Oaks in Washington, D.C., and the Anne Marie Sculptor Garden in Solomons, Maryland. Her paintings are in collections throughout the country, and most recently in the Book of Botanical Paintings, Native Plants of the Mid-Atlantic, edited by Bonnie S. Driggers. Lee maintains a studio in St. Michael's, Maryland, where she draws inspiration from her neighbors' gardens and from the native wildflowers of Maryland's eastern shore. Denise Swain is a master gardener, botanical artist, and past president of the Kent Island, Maryland Garden Club. In our second half hour of the program, it's murder and mayhem as we talk to mystery writer John Reisinger about his murder mysteries and particularly about his acclaimed nonfiction work, Master Detective. Master Detective is about the life and times of New Jersey detective Ellis Parker and his work on the famous Lindbergh kidnapping case. But first, it's what do bluebirds eat and the importance of native plants and to the ecology of our environment. Lee and Denise, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lee and Denise, you are both botanical artists and both have certificates in botanical art. What is botanical art and how did both of you come to become involved in it? Why don't you start, Lee?
Okay. Botanical art is a blend of art and science. It's the artistic interpretation of a plant that is done with botanical accuracy. I became involved in botanical art because I started my career as in landscape architecture because I liked to draw. And then someone invented a computer and I could no longer draw. So I was drawn to botanical art because it gave me an opportunity to draw and fed on my interest and knowledge in plants. So it seemed like a perfect fit.
Seems like so. Denise?
Well, I've been painting and drawing my entire life, and I've
been interested in gardening for quite a while. So it is, again, a perfect marriage of those two things for me.
Well, there's a deep history to botanical art, I understand. And Lee, tell us a little bit about the history. Why do we have botanical art anyway? I mean, I can understand the beauty of flowers and other plants and painting them as background in the master's paintings and so forth. But there's a deeper history to botanical art and a more important history to it, I understand. What is that?
The origins of botanical art go back thousands of years, and they're really based on man's dependency upon plants for food, for shelter, for clothing, for our very existence. And so early on, it became very important to somehow identify and codify those plants that were beneficial and those plants that were toxic. A very good example of this is in Greece, a tome was written called De Discordia Medica, which was a record of over 600 medicinal plants. This became the basis for Greek medicine, for Greek plant knowledge. With the fall of the Greek Empire, the Muslims captured this book, and for over 1,000 years, it was the basis of their plant knowledge. They copied it, they preserved it, they studied it, and brought it into Western Europe. When Spain, when the Moors in Spain were conquered, part of the booty was this ancient Greek tome on botanical plants, and it became the basis of Western plant knowledge. From the Middle Ages on, monks and religious have studied plants, illustrated them, and with the Renaissance, there was a renewed interest in plants. Just as art became more sophisticated, the way we recorded plants became more sophisticated. And the high point really came with exploration. When, in early days of exploration, and a critical part of the expeditions that went out were the botanical illustrators and the botanists, because so many new plants were brought back to Europe. The potato, the tomato, decorative plants, medicinal plants, all became introduced into European culture, and they were documented by botanical artists. You then see the rich having these wonderful collections of plants, and to document the plants, they hired botanical artists such as Redoté, who prepared tomes of the books of the gardens of the rich and famous. This has carried on with printing. Those originals became readily available to people, and they were able to hang art on their walls. Mm-hmm. This has passed on for generations to generations, and today we find botanical art hanging on the walls of our homes and our offices, and they are considered a very traditional form of art, but they had a very practical basis.
So these very early drawings and paintings, it seems to me, must have been very, very important for the development of medicine back in the Middle Ages and forward.
Absolutely. Not only medicine, but also to know which plants they could cultivate for food sources. And It continued on as a broad basis of plant knowledge.
In addition, as you say, how to identify poisonous plants, plants that you don't want, for instance, to eat. So there must have been that purpose.
Absolutely.
As well, you talk about books of botanical art early. Mm-hmm. Are these books available? How does one find these early master drawings of plants? And
well, if you find one of the early original books or collections, portfolios of garden paintings, you're set for life. Most of them have been separated. And they have been matted and framed, and the antique botanical art has come from full portfolios.
So you've got to find them hanging on people's walls.
You've got to find them hanging,
if you're going to find them,
or from from someone who sells prints or botanical art. But there are lots of reproductions. There are lots of books that reproduce either specific paintings, or they will give you a book might be the history of botanical art or the botanical art of a specific species. So there are lots of reference books available on botanical art.
Well, that leads us to some degree, to the importance of this book that you worked on, Native Plants of the Mid-Atlantic. It says a book for artists and gardeners, but it's in going through it, it looks to me like a book also for those who appreciate beauty and who appreciate good art as well. How did either of you become involved with this book, and why is this book important today?
Well, this book was developed by a nonprofit group called Botanical Artists for Education and the Environment. The mission of this group is to educate the public about native plants and the importance of native plants in our environment. They sent out a call for entries to botanical artists to paint a selected list of native plants. The purpose of the book was not only to serve as an opportunity to view botanical art paintings, but also to learn more about the specific plants. And with each plant is a description of the plant, a description of the cultural requirements of the plant, how it can be used in our home gardens, and also the pollinators that are dependent upon these plants. So it is a help to gardeners because it tells them the cultural requirements and the benefits of specific plants. And hopefully it's a pleasure to anyone who enjoys beautiful paintings of plants.
Well, I can agree with that. It's certainly a pleasure to go through and look at these beautiful paintings. Watercolor, I assume most of them are, or are there oils as well?
There are a number of media. The majority of paintings are in watercolor, which is the traditional medium for botanical art. But there are also graphite, oils and acrylics in the collection. It depends upon the medium of preference of the specific artist.
But no photographs.
No.
And let me ask you, it seems that you would get, and I ask this as a question, it just seems to me that you would get more accuracy perhaps with a photograph. Why the emphasis on painting rather than simply photographing these things for a record of them?
Botanical art must be botanically correct. The artist must understand the botany. In designing a painting, the artist understands each element of that particular plant and will create a painting showing all of those elements. That many times you cannot capture that through a photograph. You don't have the depth. Additionally, botanists rely upon botanical illustrators to do the final documentation of plants. The Smithsonian Institution has a botanical illustrator who, in pen and ink, illustrates each plant that they discover or they study, because it is a more accurate way to document all of the parts of a specific plant.
Yeah, they often have the exact measurements of the plant and different stages of the plant, not just the blossom. Often they have the seed, the leaves, the bud. So they have the whole life cycle almost of the plant, often in the painting represented.
Well, we could spend all of our time, obviously, now talking about botanical art, but there are some other things I would like to get at. And one of them is, we talk about native plants. What are indigenous plants? Is that the same as native plants? And why are they important?
That is the same. And they are important because they live in an area that they've been acclimated to. They have the right amount of water here. They have the right kind of temperature. So these plants have been here a very long time. And they offer food for various insects and creatures that also live in this area.
Now, when you say a long time, a long time to me can be the time between breakfast and lunch. When you say a long time, I'm assuming you mean they've evolved up here, or?
Yes, exactly. They were here probably before people were here, mm-hmm. and they have evolved. And sometimes in a garden center, you can buy a native plant that is a hybrid of the original plant, but it is more appealing to have in your home garden. But the pollen and the fruit from those plants and berries or nuts are totally important for the creatures who live here or who even are passing by on their way to migrate somewhere.
Well, you were, when we chatted once before, you were mm-hmm. talking about some kind of plants that develop flowers that develop underground. Tell us about the plant that develops. I just find that very intriguing.
I think a
blossom or something that flowers underground. And,
well, I'm going to let Lee talk about that because it's her favorite plant.
Okay, Lee. Tell us about your favorite plant. And why is it important, an important plant?
Okay. The plant that you're referring to is the skunk cabbage. And the skunk cabbage is a native plant. It evolved in place. It is found in low, wet areas throughout the Eastern Shore. And it is in the arum family. In the winter, when nothing else is in bloom, the flower has developed underground and it generates heat. It generates its own heat and that defrosts the surrounding soil, allowing this flower, which is, it's really rather otherworldly looking, this flower pops up and there is nothing else on the ground but these rather oddly shaped flowers. And the flowers are a strange green and a very dark, dark red. They have evolved. It's called skunk flower, or the skunk cabbage, because it smells. And through evolution, this plant has evolved to attract the only pollinators that are out in the winter. And those pollinators are flies. The flies are attracted to the smell and to the color, which is the color of rancid meat. And so these flies come to these lowly little plants. And by March, the flowers have been pollinated and they're dying, and then huge leaves replace the flowers, and the leaves themselves are what looks like skunk, which look like cabbages. Wildlife feeds on the skunk cabbage, and by June, there's nothing left. There's no sign. They are called an ephemeral. They live for just a short period. There's no sign. They go back underground to come back the next winter.
So they do come back.
Absolutely. They're perennials.
Yeah.
So they come back each year.
Well, you mentioned pollinators, and clearly pollinators are crucially important to the spread of plants and flowers throughout the world, really. Denise, tell us just a little bit about the pollinators, for example, on the Eastern Shore that we might be familiar with.
Okay, well, the entire food chain depends on the pollinators. So the pollinators we may see on the Eastern Shore would be butterflies, bees, bats, some birds, hummingbirds.
Is my bluebird a pollinator that
yes.
I started that I started this session
yes,
with?
Absolutely. The plants depend on pollen moving from one plant to another to fertilize the eggs of that plant, so they can produce fruit, and then the fruit produces seeds. So without the pollinators, there would be no fruit and or no seeds. I mean, seeds are important for wheat, soybeans. I mean, there's a huge list of plants that depend on this. And some of the pollinators depend on the pollen for food, bees especially, and the nectar from the flowers. The hummingbirds depend on that. The butterflies depend on that. So it is a huge chain, and it's very important.
I wanted to ask you about the bees, because we hear on the news fairly often that the bee population, which is crucial for some farmers, mm-hmm. As well as our own environment, mm-hmm. Are dying off. Have they discovered yet why these bees are dying off?
Well, I did get the information from the Natural Resource Defense Council on the bees, and they suggest that it could be pesticide exposure, it could be an invasive parasite which attacks the bees, a mite, and inadequate food supply, and that would bring in, we need more native plants because the bees depend on native plants. A new virus that's targeting the bees' immune system. So it could be any of those things. And there really is a lot of information on the internet that people could, you know, read about.
It sounds from what you're saying is that they really haven't discovered a specific reason yet, so they can attack that reason and begin to help preserve the bee population. Am I right about that?
That's correct. And I think that there's several reasons. So it's not just one specific thing. Probably depends on which part of the country you're in, the climate, and what is, you know, affecting the bees in that specific area.
Well, as far as the environment and ourselves and our bluebirds and what we feed on is concerned, we could be in serious trouble if we begin to destroy our pollinators like the bees.
Absolutely. I think they are the base of the pyramid for the food.
Are the pollinators?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, if one wanted to start a garden or wanted to improve one's garden, what are the resources that are available out there for them?
Well, I feel a very good resource would be the Extension Service. And University of Maryland has an Extension Service. Their website is www.extension.umd.edu. Most state universities have Extension Services. They educate citizens to become master gardeners through the counties. Those master gardeners are available to answer questions about gardening, to give you resources where to buy plants. And so that would be a really good resource. Another good resource would be a garden club. Garden clubs are very interested in taking care of the environment. So for Maryland, the Federated Garden Clubs of Maryland, their website is www.fgcofmd.org. Any of those groups would help you. And if you're interested in having native plants in your garden, which I highly recommend in a perennial garden, there's a wonderful resource on the Eastern Shore called Adkins Arboretum. It's so nice to have a place where you can go experience the plant firsthand, see how it grows in the environment, rather than just looking at a picture in a book. And that is really a marvelous place. Their information, where is it here, Lee?
Yeah, if I could add about Adkins. Adkins is...
You teach at Adkins, I
teach botanical,
Lee.
Yeah, so I have this special interest. Okay. But Adkins is an arboretum of native plants. If anyone wants to actually experience them firsthand, I would urge you to go to Adkins Arboretum. They have guided tours on the weekend where they go on hikes through all of the different ecosystems explaining what are the native plants. They have a nursery that sells native plants. They have a bookstore with all kinds of references available for purchase. They also have free literature on native plants and the use of native plants in home gardens. And they also teach classes. They have workshops on native plants, and they also have workshops on designing the home garden using native plants. So it is an incredible resource. Their mission is to educate the public about our own native environment and encourage people to be stewards of that environment. Adkins' website is adkinsarboretum.org. And I would just urge people, it's in Ridgely, Maryland, right off 404. Mm-hmm. And it's just a lovely experience.
Yes. And it's spelled A-D-K-I-N-S, Adkins.
Very good. I'm just wondering, Denise, we have just a couple of minutes left, but very, very quickly, if people's gardens are going to bed now, and they're going to, I don't know that they lie dormant, the skunk cabbage sure doesn't through the winter, I don't know if anything else does, what should gardeners be doing now to get their gardens ready to last through the winter and then to come to life again in the spring?
Well, I took some of these points off of the checklist from the Watering Can, which is the Queen Anne County Master Gardener newsletter. They suggest that you continue watering because we still have some hot days, so you don't want to forget about watering the plants and keeping the soil moist. I would remove any perennial weeds, not just annual weeds, and divide and cut back established perennials. You could take cuttings from some of your favorites and get ready to winter those over inside. Clean and organize your tools, which I always recommend doing, but I never seem to get around to it myself. So there's a great list, fall checklist on the website.
On the website. Yes. That's wonderful. I just want to mention that finally this book, Native Plants of the Mid-Atlantic. The art in it is fantastic, and you have a painting in it as well, Lee. I found quite beautiful, and very interesting. We could certainly go on and on. We've not even scratched the surface of the subject, but I want to thank you both very, very much for coming on the program and talking with us about native plants and the pollinators and what the bluebird eats and what the bluebird provides in terms of being a pollinator as well. A fascinating discussion. Thank you for joining us on Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break now, and when we return, it will be Murder and Mayhem with author John Reisinger. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. My guest for this segment of the program is mystery writer John Reisinger. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition, John.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
John lives in Eastern Maryland on the Eastern Shore of Maryland and writes fiction and nonfiction books with historical themes. His book, Master Detective, was a candidate for an Edgar for crime nonfiction, and two of his other books have won gold medals from the Golden Ebook Awards. John has appeared on the TV series Mysteries at the Museum, and several of his talks have been broadcast on local public television. John, you're quite a prolific writer of both fiction and nonfiction. How many books have you written?
10 so far, 3 historical novels, 1 biography, 5 mysteries, and a children's book. And I have another one coming out in January.
And we'll talk about that a little bit later in the program, your new book that you have coming out. I noticed that many of your books, almost all of them, except for the children's book, are crime stories and have a historical theme to them. You're an engineer by training, I understand, and you had a career as an engineer. Where in the world did this interest in crime and in writing about crime from a historical perspective come from?
Well, the crime was almost incidental. When I wrote Master Detective, I thought it was a compelling story. Ellis Parker, his career and his downfall, and his involvement in the Lindbergh kidnapping. I didn't pick it because it was crime. I thought it was a great story. And in researching it, I came across a lot of records of crimes of the 20s and 30s, and I thought they were pretty interesting. And a little later on, I found out some more information about one of the crimes up in New Jersey, the Wilson Roberts case, and decided that it was a great story in its own. Not quite enough for a nonfiction book because it turned out to be a murder-suicide, but I thought if it turned out a little differently, it would have made a great mystery. So I wrote a mystery based on that, and that was Death of a Flapper. So that was the genesis of a series of mysteries based on real-life crimes, which I thought made it more interesting, and in which I had an explanation of the back of the book on what the crime was. As far as mysteries themselves, they're kind of nice in a way from a writer's point of view because they have a built-in MacGuffin. If you remember what Alfred Hitchcock used to say, every story needs a MacGuffin. The MacGuffin is the object of the story, the thing that people are doing. They're looking for a treasure. They're trying to get revenge or something. That's the MacGuffin. Well, in the mystery, the MacGuffin's already there. There's a crime. Either someone wants to commit it, someone wants to solve it, or someone wants to prevent it. So you have a basic framework of the story already, and everything revolves around that. So that's where the mystery came from.
So Death of a Flapper was one of your earlier pieces?
Yes, it was the first of the Max Herlock Roaring Twenties mystery, and was based on a real-life double murder in a locked room in Morristown, New Jersey. And I had written about it. Ellis Parker handled the first case, the real case. And I had written about it, but not that much. There wasn't a whole lot of information. But I was contacted after the book came out by someone who lived in Morristown, a retired heart surgeon, no less, who said, I know about this. I know where it took place, and I know the people that live in the house. And I have a file of old newspaper clippings, if you're interested. So I couldn't turn that down. So we went up and saw the murder scene in the house and met the people and looked at the clips. And I thought, this is a great story. But my problem was, it turned out to be a murder-suicide. I thought, you know, no one's going to want to plow through a long nonfiction book and to have that kind of an ending. So I thought, you know, this would make a great mystery if it came out a little different. So I changed the names around a little bit and took the basic structure, and that became Death of a Flapper.
New Jersey appears in a number of your books. What is your connection with New Jersey? Does it all go back to this article in Death of a Flapper?
Well, all it goes back to Death of a Flapper. Goes back to Master Detective, really. Ellis Parker, of course, was a chief of detectives in Burlington County, New Jersey, and most of his cases took place in New Jersey. So a lot of the cases that I dug up, that's where they took place. But the other books in the series go to Florida, New York City, Jekyll Island, Georgia, and even Chesapeake Bay in Maryland.
Well, what interests me is these novels and Master Detective obviously are all based on real people and real situations, as you've said. When you're combining historical events with fiction, there've got to be some rules, John, that you've got to make sure that you're hitting. Is that accurate? And if so, what are the rules that you have to use when combining fiction and nonfiction?
Well, there's different ways of doing it. You'll see people who will write books such as Shakespeare's autobiography, which is purports to be a real person writing when he's really making most of it up. And you'll see another variation where a fictional character interacts with real historic people, which is what mine pretty much is. And then on the other end is everything's made up. It just happens to be in a historic era. As far as rules, the basic rule, I think, in any kind of historical fiction or historical related is accuracy. Try to capture the era. And now in the era of the internet, that's easier to do than ever. And get the details right. Nothing is going to sandbag the story faster than having an anachronism, like having George Washington talking on a cell phone or Henry VIII saying...
That's a little extreme, I'd say.
Henry VIII saying, give me a break. Well, you know, I almost did it. When I first wrote Death of a Flapper, I had one of the flappers saying, boop, boop, be doo. Well, everybody knows that's what flappers said all the time in the 20s. Well, as it turns out, it wasn't. That expression didn't come along until the 30s. When I checked it out, I found out, and nobody says, still say the bee's knees, though.
And the ocelot's elbow, or whatever, sure. whatever the other sayings on through there.
Which brings up the next rule, and that is, you can't lay it on too thick, because if people have to wade through a lot of jargon and a lot of detail to get to the story, they're going to lose interest. I call it the pizza theory, and that is, the historical research in the historical book is like the sauce in a pizza. If there's not enough, it's tasteless and no good. But if there's too much, it's a big sloppy mess that no one's going to swallow. So you have to have just the right amount. And it's so easy to get carried away with the internet and just get big globs of exposition. And not everyone wants to know all that detail.
Right. Well, I really did enjoy Death of a Flapper. And I kind of liked, we'll talk about this in a moment, Allison's writing her articles at the same time that the mystery is being solved, and that really intrigues me, and I do want to talk to you more about that in a moment. But what I did enjoy very much Death of a Flapper, and what I found was, and you can comment on this if you would, the difference that you expressed through your character in the flappers that were kind of the big city flappers, and the flappers as they were found in the smaller communities.
Yes, that was something I really wasn't aware of when I started this either. But it was very much a matter of opportunity. And in fact, a high school girl contacted me afterwards. She read the book and she said, "Well, I'm doing a report on flappers." And she asked me a bunch of questions. They were pretty good questions. But one of them, she said, "Well, weren't flappers really like the first, weren't they political activists and early going for women's rights?" And I said, "No, they weren't really the cause of women's rights. They were the result. Women had gotten the vote. There was more household appliances. They didn't have to stick around the house as much. They'd been working in the factories in World War I, and things were loosened up, and women had a lot more opportunities. But it wasn't really evenly distributed. If you lived in a big city, if a young woman lived in a big city and had a job and was independent, then she could go do whatever. But the ones in the small town still living with mom and dad, there's only so far they could go.
That skirt can only be so short."
Yeah,
when you walk through the living room to go out in the evening.
Sure, and and if you're in downtown Manhattan, you know, mom's not going to be looking at you.
Right. No, exactly.
So there were differences, but I kind of use the example of hippies. Back in the '60s, there were hardcore folks wandering around San Francisco and, you know, smoking dope and all everything you associate with them. But there were a lot of people in small towns and things like that that weren't really doing that stuff, but they were sort of influenced. They were saying "man" all the time, and they were dressing in flowered shirts, and their hair was getting longer, and they had suits with gigantic lapels and bell bottoms so wide you could hardly see their legs when they were walking. All those things. So women who weren't actually flappers were affected by the whole movement, if you will.
Well, I again, as I said, I found it a very interesting book, and the other book though that I find fascinating is your third book, I believe, Master Detective. Tell us a little bit about Master Detective and Ellis Parker and the genesis for writing this an extensively researched piece of work that you've put together here, and I think, frankly, a very impressive piece of work.
Well, thank you. I really started writing Master Detective. I wrote a book about Ellis Parker because I couldn't find a book to read. I started out, I found out about him from a small article in the People's Almanac about real-life detectives and their most impressive and their most famous cases. And the very first one was Ellis Parker and the Case of the Pickled Corpse. Well, who could resist a title like that? So I read that, and it was pretty interesting. And at the end, it mentioned that he was involved in the Lindbergh kidnapping. And just a paragraph about it, I said, "What? I never heard of this guy. How did I never heard of this?" So I started looking up on the internet to see what I could find out about Ellis Parker, and every hit that I got was Ellis Parker Butler, who was a humorist, mm-hmm. whose most famous book was called Pigs as Pigs. I figured that wasn't the right guy. But I did find one website, which is put up by his grandson as sort of a memorial. It had old newspaper clippings and everything. And the more I read, the more interesting it sounded. And I thought, you know, this guy really had a life that was so interesting, he deserves a biography, even if he had never gotten involved in the Lindbergh kidnapping. So I contacted the grandson and asked if I'd have his cooperation, and he agreed, and I wrote the book based on that. As far as Ellis Parker himself, he was the chief of detectives in Burlington County, New Jersey, and he was like the old Columbo type, you know, just a non-assuming, almost a hayseed sort of a guy, and not really GQ.
He worked for the city of Mount Holly, or he worked for the county?
It was Burlington County. Mount Holly is where his office was, the county seat.
And so what was his position?
He was the chief of detectives.
Chief of detectives,
and
okay.
He pretty much got a reputation, well-deserved, of solving just about every case, even the ones that had everybody else scratching their heads. And he used deduction. It wasn't a whole lot of CSI stuff. He didn't use fingerprints very much because there was no central fingerprint bank anyway. Nobody knew about DNA in those days. It was just a matter of talking to people, reconstructing the crime in his mind, because he was a good psychologist. He really understood people and how they reacted. And as I tell people, he was a local hero. I mean, everybody knew Ellis, called him by his first name.
Remind us of the period again. Lindbergh was 32, 33.
Yes, Lindbergh was 32. But the bulk of Parker's career was prior to that, from the turn of the century up and through the 20s and into the 30s. And by that time, he was just top of the heap. And I tell people, if he had died or retired in 1931, there'd probably be a statue of him on the courthouse lawn up there. But he didn't.
Yeah.
He was getting towards the end of the career. He didn't have much left to prove. But a lot of things happened that all came together that I detail in the book that sort of led him into this. First of all, the New Jersey State Police had been established, and they were sort of a rival, and he didn't like the competition, and he didn't have any use for H. Norman Schwarzkopf.
I found it interesting that H. Norman Schwarzkopf was the father
of the
Gulf War general now, Stormin' Norman,
yes,
I guess.
Yes, exactly. And he was an administrator. He wasn't as good a detective as Ellis Parker, but he didn't pretend to be. And Parker was always trying to outwit him and usually succeeding. But then when the Lindbergh kidnapping came along, it didn't happen in Parker's county. Happened in the next county over. So he had no official authority to investigate. The state gave the investigation to the state police. So Parker's on the sidelines. And he didn't like that too much. He wanted to get in on the action. And I think one of the reasons was he wanted to have a big score. He was a fan of justice. He wanted to see justice done. But I think he wanted to be there when it happened. He sought the publicity. He liked to be on the front page, and he was a lot. He knew all the reporters by their first name. So he wanted to be in on this, and he wasn't. And as the case played out, he did his own investigation behind the scenes. He found another suspect after Bruno Hauptmann, if you remember the case, was arrested and convicted and sentenced to die in the electric chair.
One of the frustrating things for Parker, who really did, as you outline in the book, I think, see himself as probably the best detective at least in New Jersey, if not in the world, and was frustrated at the way the investigation of the Lindbergh case was being carried out. What do you say, 200 people or something like that were
depending
involved
on who you count,
in this investigation?
Yeah. Yes, everybody in the country was investigating in some fashion. They had a door-to-door search in Pittsburgh for some reason, never found anything. So, yeah, everyone wanted to be part of it because Charles Lindbergh was the most, like the biggest hero in America at the time. Right. It was only 5 years since he had been the first person to go solo over the Atlantic, and you know, he was the rock star. But Parker, you're right, was very frustrated at this, and he figured he could do a better job. Maybe he could have. In this case, I believe his penchant for publicity sort of worked against him. I think the state authorities were kind of afraid to give him any real authority in this, that he would swoop in, take all the bows, and they'd look foolish, especially with the state police. For whatever reason, he was sort of out in the cold.
The new state police,
they didn't come about until 1921, and Parker was against it. He said it would take resources away from the locals, and he was right, it did. They were established, and he went on about his business, and sometimes he cooperated, sometimes he didn't. But it was sort of an irritant to him. And now he saw the police getting the resources, the publicity, and not really coming up with a whole lot of results. It wasn't the state police that arrested Bruno Hauptmann. It was the New York police, because that's where he lived. They traced him through, he passed a part of the ransom money at a gas station in the Bronx. So New Jersey really wasn't even part of it at that time. Of course, he was brought to New Jersey because that's where the crime occurred. So he was sentenced. Parker focused on another person, a person named Paul Wendell, who was a disbarred attorney from Trenton that Parker had known for years.
An old friend of his, in
yes,
fact. And had worked for Parker, I believe, at one time.
Yeah, he had offered to help Parker in his informal investigation, and he kept phoning in leads, which always went nowhere, and asking for more money to help, and that kind of thing. He was staying in New York City in a hotel because he was wanted on several warrants for embezzlement in New Jersey. He was afraid to come back. So Parker had no authority to arrest him. But Parker believed, through reasons I go into in the book, that Wendell was the guy. And now the wrong person was going to be executed in Parker's mind. Parker went to see Houtman in jail and interviewed him and came away a believer because Houtman was very convincing.
Parker had help in terms of who was it, the governor or the...
The new governor set Parker up as sort of an independent investigation, ostensibly for the purpose of finding out if there was anyone else involved in the kidnapping than Bruno, thinking it was a conspiracy of some sort. Well, Parker came up with a new person altogether who... he said was responsible, and of course that
was
Wendell.
But it was the governor that stayed with Parker through thick and thin.
Pretty much,
this began to deteriorate.
Governor Hoffman, now that's confusing because you got Houtman, you got Hoffman.
Yeah.
But Governor Hoffman supported Parker and sort of went out on a limb. Parker had, Wendell had some, deputized some people in Brooklyn that he knew, because he knew people everywhere, who posed as law enforcement agents, abducted Wendell off the street in New York and took him to a house in Brooklyn where he was confined and encouraged to confess, which after about a week or so of various incentives, he did. And Parker took the confession to the Board of Pardons, and the governor granted Houtman a stay of execution until it could be investigated. Right. Well, everything was in turmoil. People were going nuts about this.
And there was a kind of torture involved, or at least...
There's some,
a third degree, it was called then,
yeah,
kind of approach.
Which was strange because Parker never used those kind of methods.
Right.
He prided himself on using psychology, and usually he had done such a good job of anticipating what the person had done, and his reputation was such that when he arrested somebody, they normally would confess pretty quickly without much encouragement because they figure, well, if Parker arrests you, he's got the goods on you anyway, so you might as well confess and get him on your side.
Well, what eventually? Because I'm really intrigued by Ellis Parker and the kind of shift in his I don't know if you call it shift, but the kind of change in his personality and his approach that occurred toward the end of his life after the execution. What happened? Was there a trial in which his suspect was?
No, his suspect was never tried.
Never went to trial.
Once he produced the suspect, Wendell recanted everything and said he'd been coerced, he'd been tortured,
and
he had nothing to do with it. And other than the confession, there really wasn't any real evidence. So the whole thing fell apart.
And his son, Parker, had his
son
involved
was part
in
of the team that kidnapped Wendell.
Right.
The district attorney in Kings County, New York, where Wendell had been kidnapped, started an investigation. They traced it back to Parker, who initially claimed he had nothing to do with it. And of course, he was a great detective, but a terrible criminal because he left a trail that was very easy to follow. And ultimately, Ellis Parker was tried and convicted of kidnapping.
Right.
Ironically, under the Lindbergh Law, which had been passed after the kidnapping to make it a federal offense, he denied everything. And I speculate in the book that if he had just fessed up and said, look, I did it, I know it was wrong now, I really believed it was the right thing to do, he might have gotten off with a suspension or something. But he denied it up to the end, even though it was clear that he was involved.
Well,
and he was sentenced to 6 years in jail,
right.
And he died after 1 year.
And he, just for a moment, he died in prison.
Yes.
And what I find fascinating in this book, and I think you draw it out quite well, is kind of the Greek tragedy aspect of this thing. Here, the first half of your book or more is really Parker solving all of these crimes in this amazing way that he had. And then all of a sudden he kind of goes over the edge and he stages the kidnapping of this guy and approves the harsh methods of getting information out of him, which seemed to me to be totally out of keeping with his personality, because he was a man of justice. Now maybe he thought that justice that he was in fact pursuing justice. But the reason I would encourage our listeners to read this book is, first of all, it's very, very interesting, and Parker's a very interesting guy, but there's really a Greek tragedy unrolling here, where this man's personality, it seems to me, just kind of explodes toward the end, and he becomes almost a different person. Do you get that sense as you were writing the book?
Or? Well, I certainly got the sense of the tragedy. It was almost a Captain Ahab thing, pursuing the white whale. As far as the personality changing, there's a lot of speculation about that. He did die of a brain tumor. Maybe it affected him. It's hard to say. But keep in mind, while all this was going on, he was solving other cases. The Bradway Brown case, one of his most famous ones, which he solved by predicting where the burglars would strike next. So he hadn't lost a whole lot. Now, maybe he went in and out. I don't know. But you're right. It was a change. He prided himself on not using coercion. Now, he didn't. The other ones did. But even so, he certainly was aware of it, if nothing else.
Right.
And I think it was a measure of how desperate he was. He honestly believed that he was saving an innocent man from the electric chair.
Well, his actions toward the end of his life, for me, are a mystery in themselves, and we'd have to delve into his personality, into his ego, into his obsession that led to that. But we have only a few minutes left, and I want to talk about, in fact, your Roaring Twenties mysteries as well, because I read a number of them, and I felt that they shared kind of a common structure throughout. All the titles begin with death. We start with that uplifting.
There's going to be death in every mystery.
That's right. Well, that's right. That's what makes it a mystery, isn't it? But we've got Max Herlock's faithful sidekick, and we've got the dual track, which was what I thought you did extremely well in this book, which was, you've got this mystery going on with Max Herlock solving the mystery, and overlaying on that, you've got his wife, who is tagging along, but she isn't just tagging along. She's writing an article like on the death of a flapper. She's writing an article on flappers and so forth. And I found that structure very, very interesting. And then, of course, there's the exposition toward the end. How did you come up with that structure? What made you think of that as a structure? And you use it in every one of these of these stories.
If you're starting to write a mystery, you're basically two ways of going. And one of them is have it in the first person, where the detective's narrating everything. And the second is the third person, where you're describing what the detective's doing. The problem with the third person is that you have to be able to say and show what the detective's thinking and how he's changing and how he's looking at these things. And you can't say he thought this and he thought that. That gets real boring. And you can't have him talking to himself because then they'll start thinking there's something wrong with him. So that's why detectives often have some sort of sidekick. Sherlock Holmes had Watson. Poirot has Hastings. And you see that a lot. And that's the reason for that device. So they can bounce ideas off of someone else and discuss the case. And the reader can go along and see what his thinking is and how it's evolving. And I wanted someone from the East, based on the Eastern Shore, because that was an interesting area. And that's where I live. And I thought that a nice Eastern Shore name like Herlock would be good. And we actually got the name Max by looking at road names. We finally found Max Road and thought, hey, that's what it should be. Hmm. And Allison is there because Allison is supplements Max. And she's an independent person of her own. And she has strong points where he doesn't and vice versa. And the device of the magazine writer, first of all, I thought is something that an educated woman like her might be doing in the 20s because there was a big market for it. And it gives the opportunity to bring in a lot of historic fact, a lot of flavor of the era. And it's always related to what Max is doing, like the flappers and the death of a flapper, the spiritualism and the death in the lighthouse. And she's writing about speakeasies and death of the blind tiger. And it gets that in. And she's always finding things as she goes along, too. And I like the idea, and maybe it started with Master Detective, I like some moral ambiguity sometimes. And I like the unexpected. I have a scene in Death at the Lighthouse where she goes in to expose a spiritualist because she's found out that it's faked. Well, everyone would expect that scene to have either the spiritualist getting upset and throwing her out or saying curses foiled again. But instead, the spiritualist is very calm and says, yes, I am a fake. But you know what? I give people a lot of comfort and as well, and it pretty much stops her in her tracks.
Well, I
have a lot of things like that. In Death and the Blind Tiger, Allison really wants to be a literary person, and she meets Dorothy Parker and goes to the Algonquin Round Table because they're in New York. And she thinks, boy, I want to be like those people. But as she gets to know them, she starts thinking, you know, they're not real nice people. I'm not sure I want to be like that. So you have this tug of war going on.
Well, I think the Madame de Souza in Death at the Lighthouse is raises an interesting ethical question for us that you leave us to ponder, which I think is good. Yes. Which I think is good. What are you currently working on?
In January, I'm going to release a book called The Confessions of Gonzalo Guerrero, historical novel based on a real person. Gonzalo Guerrero was a would-be Spanish conquistador who was shipwrecked on the coast of the Yucatan in 1511 before the Spaniards knew about the place. 6 years later, when Cortez showed up, not only was Guerrero still alive, but he was leading the Maya in their resistance to the Spaniards. He had a wife and three kids by that time.
That will come out as an ebook, or
yes, right now I'm playing it as an ebook only.
Okay.
In January.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing another
moral dilemma there.
Oh, wait. I like moral dilemmas.
After he's lived with them, he's been shipwrecked. He has no hope of ever getting home. He adapts, and he winds up, you know, as one of them. Does he go with the Spaniards when they come back, or does he go with his family, or does he go with his country?
Well, we'll look forward to that, John. The time went all too quickly for us. Thank you very much for being here today and sharing your insights with us. Your books are enjoyable, entertaining, instructive, and informative. I think particularly Master Detective is a fantastic work and a real tour de force. I want to tell my readers to visit John's website at www.johnreisinger.com, and you'll find much more about his mysteries and his work. Okay, all you mystery writers out there, sharpen your wits, lay out your labyrinth of events, and challenge our imaginations. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Thank you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.